All right. Now then, it is quite obvious that Palestine is one of the smaller countries of the world. It isn't very big as countries go. Roughly 10,500 square miles, that's quite small. Its importance is certainly not in its size, but in the things that have happened there and its influence on world history. This is the place where the action was in Bible history, and especially in God's great plan to redeem the world through the redemptive work of His Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ. It took place in Palestine. Now we have people today who scoff at Christianity and say that it is inconceivable that God, who is so great, if there is any God, of course, would pay any attention to anything as small as this earth, a mere speck of rock in the universe. And even in the solar system, it isn't very big. But God would not pay attention to anything so small. Now let's stop and consider that a little before we take up the smallest of Palestine. First of all, the smallest of this earth. Is it true that the importance of something depends on its size? Mr. Thompson, you think it does?
No.
Not necessarily, at least. Now, asked a fellow last year, which would you rather have, a Mercedes-Benz, a new one with all the options, or a 6-ton GM truck? He said, I'll take the truck. I could sell it for more money. Well, I suppose you could, but a good many students would rather have the Mercedes-Benz. But since he was rather perverse and said he'd take the truck, I asked one of the young ladies present, which would you rather have, a diamond ring or a ton of anthracite coal? Said, you know, chemically, they're both pretty nearly pure carbon. Not the ring, but the diamond is. And anthracite coal is, too, not quite as pure carbon as a diamond, but still it's got a lot of carbon in and just a little bit of ash. Which would you rather have, a diamond ring or a ton of anthracite coal? Now, any Geneva co-ed that would rather have the ton of anthracite coal needs to be re-educated. Something's wrong with somebody like this. Now, let me tell you, the diamond ring is more important and it costs a lot more, lots more. Also, to all you young ladies present, if you get a diamond ring, just remember some fellow's heart and dreams went into that. And it's not just a piece of jewelry. So treat it seriously. It really means something. Now then, the diamond ring is much smaller. They don't weigh it in tons, but in carats. And a really good one, you know, it costs money. I saw a cartoon in the paper of a starry-eyed couple in a jewelry store shopping for a diamond ring, and she says to him, isn't this romantic, our first time payment purchase? Well, it's romantic no matter how it's purchased. Anyway, obviously, let's say this earth is very small. The planet Jupiter is much larger. Is it therefore more important? Now, as far as known, there is not, never has been life on Jupiter. And probably it is uninhabitable and could not sustain life. Although I don't suppose you could say this absolutely. But much larger than this earth, is it therefore more important in the mind and plan of God than this earth? Well, certainly not. Beaver Falls is more important than 50 square miles of the Sahara Desert, too. Beaver Falls, of course, where Geneva College is located. That makes it important. Now, certainly, this earth is important because it is the home of the human race, created, if you please, in the image of God. And it is the place where the eternal Son of God was born as a human baby and became man and was crucified and rose from the dead and so forth for our eternal redemption. This puts this little earth of ours in the diamond ring category, not in the anthracite coal category. Now then, so much for the earth. With regard to Palestine, while in square miles and dimensions it is very small, This is the place where the great drama was acted out. This is where the Savior of the world was born, lived and died, and rose again, and therefore it is important from this standpoint. Also, this is the place where Christianity originated. Now, I presume you haven't taken Bible 202, although some students, as a matter of conscience, take these four courses in reverse order, 202, 201, 102, 101. It's a sort of a scruple or something. It's like going to a movie in the middle, you know. You can guess how it's going to begin as well as how it's going to end. But if you have taken or will take later Bible 202, you'll realize that is the story of the book of Acts, mostly, which tells how early Christianity got its center shifted from Jerusalem to Rome. The book of Acts starts out in Jerusalem, and certainly that was the original center of Christianity. And by the time the book ends, the center of the early Christian movement has been shifted from Jerusalem to Rome. Soon after that, Jerusalem was destroyed, and it passed out of the picture as far as that was concerned. So this is where Christianity originated. This gives Palestine an importance that its size or dimensions could never give it. All right. So this cannot be a mere coincidence that Christianity originated there in this particular location. This must be an intended plan or design of God. Now, there are how many continents in the world, on a globe of the world? So how many there are? Huh? Seven, all right. Europe, Asia, Africa, North America, South America, Australia, and Antarctica. Am I right? Besides some islands. Now, of these, North America, South America, Australia, and Antarctica do not count in world history until modern times. They were there, of course, and some people lived there, but they did not enter into the continuity of world history until after Christopher Columbus and Magellan. A student objected to this statement and said I was very unfair to Leif Erikson. I think he was quite a guy, but permanent settlement and connection between the old world and the new started with Columbus, not with Leif Erikson. That's historically demonstrable. All right? So we'll leave out North America, South America, Australia, and Antarctica. They are not part of world history until about 500 or less years ago. Australia in the 1700s. So that leaves Europe, Asia, and Africa, the three great land masses of the old world. And of these three, Palestine is approximately in the center between them. If you think of a clover leaf, a three-leaf clover, I don't mean a turnpike clover, but a green clover that grows, and look at it, the place where the stem joins the three leaves of it would be where Palestine is located on a globe of the world. If you would start out from near Jerusalem and walk southwestward in a comparatively short journey, you would be across the Suez Canal and in Africa. If you would start and go eastward, you would have several thousand miles to go, 8,000 or 9,000 anyhow, but you would end up at the Pacific Ocean. And if you would start to go northwestward, you would come across the Bosphorus and into Europe. You would be in the Balkan Peninsula of Europe. So here is Palestine, roughly in the center between Europe, Asia, and Africa, the three great land masses of the old world, and that fit together in a continuity of history. Now, suppose that Christianity had originated, instead of in Palestine, on Easter Island in the far South Atlantic, about 800 miles, I believe, off the coast of Chile, a place that was only discovered fairly recently. Easter Island, where they have those tremendous stone monuments of human heads, very mysterious. I think virtually uninhabited. There may be a radio station or something like that there today, but Easter Island. Or suppose Christianity had originated on the island of Spitsbergen, near the Arctic, north of Russia. Now, can you imagine the difficulty and the delay with which it would have taken for it to reach the parts of the world where most of the people live? But you see, it didn't. It originated in a central location from which it could fan out in all directions. And it did. And this must have been a plan of God intended to facilitate the movement of the gospel of Jesus Christ to the peoples of the world. Now, the early apostles and missionaries traveled on Roman roads. The Roman Empire, they were great engineers and great in construction, of course, and they built roads or highways. Some of these are still in existence. A little bit bumpy for your motor scooter, but you'll never get stuck in the mud on a Roman road. The Appian Way in central Italy and others in other places, that you know, they dug deep and put in big blocks of stone, and the Roman roads are going to be there while the world lasts. And there, some of them you can bump along in a wagon or a cart or a truck on them today, even. Now, the Romans built these for their own purposes. These were intended to move their army and their legions to the places they held power over. But Rome, they and the Christian church lived on. Where is the Roman Empire today? Dead and gone. And Christianity outlived the Roman Empire. And these roads were used by the early apostles and missionaries to carry the Christian message to all the places that they went to. Within a very few years after the time of Jesus Christ, Christianity had reached India in the east and France in the west, and probably within the first 50 to 100 years after the time of Christ, it had reached what is today England. So you see, the central location had a great deal to do with it. Now, also, the central location of Palestine meant that it was in the traffic way between the early civilizations. Look at that map here. The two earliest civilizations, as you know, if you have put through Humanities 101, I see an interesting exhibit out by the flagpole this morning that honors Humanities 101. Venus, I suppose, not the planet Venus, but the goddess Venus, presumably, or is it the Venus de Milo? But anyway, Palestine was subject to cross-cultural currents. The two oldest centers of civilization and human culture, as far as known, were Egypt and the Tigris-Euphrates Valley over here. It used to be supposed that that of Egypt was the oldest. This is today known to be untrue. Egypt was discovered and investigated by archaeologists older than the other civilizations. It began with Napoleon, I guess. But thank you first. It began with Napoleon Bonaparte about 1805. Most of what is in Egypt that is important is above ground, like the pyramids, very obvious. In the Tigris-Euphrates Valley over here, most of what is important from the standpoint of prehistory and very early history is deep underground. Some places they had to dig 40 feet through debris and deposits to reach the level of an ancient culture. Some places as much as 80 feet. It is believed that this is somewhat the older, and there's one place in India that is probably an equal age to this. Anyhow, here we are. Palestine is between the two. There was always traffic back and forth between the two, both in peace and in war. That caravan of traders, to whom Joseph's 10 older brothers, so kind and loving, you remember, sold him for 20 pieces of silver, was almost certainly passing back and forth between Egypt and the Euphrates, plying a caravan trade, carrying whatever they could buy and sell again at a profit that wasn't too heavy to move. Now, this meant that the only practicable way to get between the two in ancient times was across Palestine. Egypt is directly east of Babylonia, or directly west. But nobody could go that way. That's the Syrian desert. It's torture even for a camel. And even today, with the modern motorized equipment, it's hardly a practicable route. They went up the Euphrates River to the point where it's nearest the coast, and they crossed over the hills here and go down the coast, always keeping in reach of drinkable water, and finally come into Egypt that way and cross Palestine, this little strip here, it's not Canaan on here, in doing it. So in peace and in war, it was in the traffic way between the two. Now this meant that civilization and developments of it got brushed off there as they went past. The alphabet, the process for producing iron, and a number of other things. Technological discoveries and inventions and literature, books, ideas, back and forth between the two. Also, in time of war, Palestine was the victim of the feet of camping armies from the giants of the Eastern world, especially Egypt, Assyria, and Babylon, as well as a couple of others that were not quite so great. And for this reason, because of its location, they got drawn into wars that originally had nothing to do with them. Just because of their location, it was the only practicable way to get there, and so people walked across Palestine, and they got involved in wars that originally they had nothing to do with the making of. The same thing has been true in Europe. There are several countries located roughly between Germany and France that have tried very hard to maintain neutrality in European wars. Belgium, Holland, Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, I believe, and Switzerland, as well as some smaller patches of real estate. Of these, only Switzerland has really been able to do it. Switzerland is neutralized by multilateral international treaties, but the real thing that has protected Switzerland is the Alps Mountains. It's no sense to get an army across Switzerland. It's much easier to go around it. So the Swiss have been protected by their mountains. There was a fellow named Hannibal that tried it, and he succeeded, but with extreme difficulty. The other countries, over and over again, have been invaded and have suffered because of wars between Germany and France. And all the treaties go down the drain when the fighting gets critical. And the saying is, necessity knows no law. Well, it should know a law, but these countries have been drawn in. Now, Palestine got involved in wars between the great powers. You realize, I'm sure, at least I hope you do, that there is more than one dimension to history. You can say Palestine suffered from and got involved in wars between the great powers because they were located where the fighting was. But in another way, you could say, in a deeper dimension, that it was because of their unfaithfulness to God. These are the covenant people of God from whom Christ would finally come. And as long as they were faithful to God, he protected them from enemies. And everything went fine. The trouble is, a good deal of the time they were not faithful to God. And in God's moral government of the world, he allowed their enemies to attack them or to invade their country. And they got involved in cruel and brutal wars, God permitting this as a moral discipline, as a way of bringing them to face their sins and to repent and turn back from, let's say, idolatry and false religion and other evils, to turn back to God. Now then, so much for the general location. We'll look at a different way. Of the country commonly given as 10,500 square miles, of course an approximate figure. What is the distance between the north and south as commonly given? Richard, express yourself on this. Yeah, 150. Now that's from Dan to Beersheba. Traditional northern and southern limits. Dan is located about here. Far north, Beersheba, way down here, into the desert. They used to say from Dan to Beersheba, as we would say from the St. Lawrence to the Rio Grande, border to border. A woman called her pastor up on the telephone and said, "Reverend, is it true that Dan and Beersheba are the name of two cities?" Somebody told me they were, and I didn't think this could be right. I always thought they were husband and wife, just like Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, Sodom and Gomorrah were also two cities. Of these four cities, Beersheba is the only one that's still in existence today. Dan to Beersheba, 150 miles as the buzzard flies. Considerably longer than that if you go on your motor scooter, because the road isn't straight, you know, like the turnpike. It winds around and up and down and in and out among the hills. So it would be considerably longer than 150, but the airline distance is roughly approximately 150. And the east to west distance given as 50 to 75, depending on whether you measure it down here where it's wider or up here where it's narrower. That scale there, that's up to 30 miles on that map. 50 to 75 for the width from the Mediterranean to the edge of the virtually unusable desert on the eastern side. This is today divided between Israel and Jordan. Bible times, it was at the best times the home of Israel exclusively. Now then, so much for the dimensions. Something about the mountains. The highest mountain in Palestine, far up on their northern border, is Mount Hermon, located here. This map says 9,232 feet. I've seen a slightly different figure in some books, but to over 9,000 and between 9 and 10,000 feet high. You realize that's way higher than anything in the United States east of the Rocky Mountains. Mount Washington in New Hampshire, is it? I have been up that on a cog railroad, and it got pretty high where nothing would grow but a little sparse grass. It goes up to 6,000 and some feet. How many have been up that little railroad? Well, that's quite a trip. You get near the top, and the thing stops a minute, and there's a sign there that says, "Danger, population center ahead." You get at the top, there's a little stand where they sell coffee and hot dogs. That's the population center of Mount Washington. 6,000 feet, that's the highest in the United States east of the Rockies. Rocky Mountains, the Continental Divide, go up to about 13,000. Mount McKinley in Alaska goes up to 21,000 feet. Now, how high are the highest mountains in Pennsylvania? Any of you folks going to teach elementary ed? This is something you'll be expected to know. Geography of Pennsylvania. How high are the highest mountains in Pennsylvania? Well, right here we're less than 1,000 feet above sea level. The highest mountains go up to the Allegheny Ridges that go from northeast to southwest diagonally across the state, about 6 or 7 of these ridges with valleys between, 2,500 feet. 2,600, 2,700, a few places up to 3,000. The highest place in Pennsylvania is Mount Davis in Somerset County, south of the Turnpike, and it is, I believe, 3,100 feet or something like that. The Turnpike used to have 7 tunnels under the ridges of the Allegheny Mountains between Harrisburg and here. 3 of these, I believe, have been eliminated by newly engineered bypasses that are safer and quicker and less of a dangerous bottleneck, if there's a wreck or something. The other ones are still in use. The Genevans Chorus one year was coming back from Boston. They've been giving their performances, Boston and New York. And coming this way on the turnpike, they had a Greyhound bus and a driver who had driven the Genevans Chorus several years and was very friendly with Geneva College and Geneva students. And as they approached the last tunnel coming this way, started to go in the tunnel, it got dark in the bus. He turned his headlights on to see ahead, but it was dark in the bus. And he turned back to the students sitting in the bus and said, "Okay, folks, this is the last tunnel. Now make this a good one." And you know, well, the Dean of Men, Dean of Women weren't on that trip, but they did have a couple of faculty sponsors who Didn't say a thing. All right. Now, the highest mountains in Palestine are just about like that, 2,500, 2,600 feet. And there's a main ridge that goes down this way, right through the middle of the country. And the summit for this is about 2,500 to 2,600 to 2,700 feet high above the Mediterranean Sea. And the streams slope off very gently towards the west and to the Mediterranean, and very steeply toward the east into the Jordan River. And this watershed ridge down the middle of the country in Abraham's day, 2000 B.C., was heavily forested with evergreen trees, pine and such as that, the coniferous trees. These are all gone today, cut down ages ago. The mountains were bare for hundreds of years. Today, the Republic of Israel is systematically reforesting this with tens of thousands of seedling trees, so the forest will come back from the upper regions of the mountains, greatly stabilizing the water supply and so forth to the great economic benefit of the country. Now then, something about the, Jerusalem, first of all. I'll tell you a gimmick for finding Jerusalem on the map. This is a gimmick. You find the northern end of the Dead Sea, like that. There's the northern end of the Dead Sea. You draw a line across there from the northern limit of the Dead Sea to the Mediterranean. And divide that imaginary line into thirds. One-third, two-thirds, and three-thirds. So you start from here, and you go one-third and two-thirds, and that's Jerusalem, and three-thirds brings you to where the Jordan River runs out in the Mediterranean Sea. You ought to be able to do that backwards and follow it. Dr. I have explained it to you that way. Now then, Jerusalem is 2,500 feet above sea level. The Bible everywhere speaks of going up to Jerusalem, no matter where you start from. You go up. The only way to get there without going up is to descend by helicopter or airplane or parachute from up in the air somewhere. On the top of a ridge, it slopes off very steeply on one side, and more gradually, but still quite a slope on the other side. This made it a high point. It was easily defended against enemies because it was up on such a height. Now, the Jordan River starts out way up here at the base of Mount Hermon. The water comes out from solid rock, from cracks in the rock, crystal clear and nearly ice cold. You couldn't find better drinking water anywhere in the world. It is pure and unpolluted from melting snow from those high mountains. And hardly anybody lives there because it is so, such a generally inaccessible place and so cold and high up. And this water, let me tell you, is better than the water we drink here at Beaver Falls. Well, maybe I haven't said much. But we get used to it after a while. But people that come here from somewhere else, they say, why do you mix sheep dip with the drinking water? We don't mix sheep dip with it, but in springtime, when there's a lot of heavy rain, it tastes like tar. So this is runoff from industrial plants. It's said to be absolutely harmless. They used to say the smoke from the corkworms was not only harmless, but beneficial. It has been proved by science that bacteria can't live in it. Anyhow, our water here isn't too good. And the Beaver River out here that we drink, let me tell you right now, it isn't clean enough to swim in. Of course, it gets chlorinated and purified more or less after a fashion. Now, this is the purest and best drinking water in the world, and it comes gushing out of little holes in the solid rock, five places. And it runs into a small lake here about 3 miles across called the Hulah, H-U-L-E-H. If you would go there today, you'd find that the Hulah is no more. It has been rained. The Republic of Israel drained it, and the Jordan River just runs right on as if there weren't any lake there. It's a narrow channel through the middle of what used to be the lake. This was extremely inaccessible. It was a haven for wild waterfowl, and pardon my humor, but strictly for the birds. Nobody could get there. You would have to wade through swampy ground with dangerous snakes likely nipping at your heels for miles to get to the water's edge, and tall weeds and brush higher than your head. And the Republic of Israel fairly recently recognized this was soil of incredible fertility. It had never been used for agriculture since the world began. So they drained it, and the wild waterfowl have all vanished. I suppose going to the bird heaven or someplace, but anyhow, it's the people today. Now, to get to here, this is 230 feet above sea level. About here, if you were following the road that runs parallel to the river, you would see a sign along the roadside that says, in English, sea level. In Hebrew, Pnei Hayam, which means the face of the sea. And in Arabic, an expression which, although I have studied Arabic, I will not attempt to pronounce, which means the roof of the sea. All three of these mean the same thing, sea level. At this point, the Jordan River is at the same altitude as the Mediterranean Sea. If somebody would dig a deep ditch or a tunnel through there, the Mediterranean Sea would rush in and all the central part of Palestine would become a vast saltwater lake. Nobody's going to do it, of course, but that's what would happen. Now, from there on, the Jordan is below sea level. Sea of Galilee, at this point, 685 feet. Listen to 696. These things vary from year to year, depending on the rainfall. They're nearly 700 feet below sea level, about 12 miles north to south and 8 or 9 across, a freshwater lake. Scarcely mentioned in the Old Testament, but very prominent in the New Testament, connected with many scenes from the life and career of Jesus. In Bible times, there were 24 species of edible fish in the Sea of Galilee. And they caught them and salted them, preserved them by salt, and shipped them as far as France and Italy. It was quite an industry. Today, only 6 species of edible fish left in the Sea of Galilee. The people that live there don't like fish, and it isn't anything like what the business used to be. Between World War I and World War II, when Palestine was a British mandate under the old League of Nations, this was a staging point for flying boats from London to Bombay, India, about halfway between the two, and these very large seaplanes would put down on the Sea of Galilee, put the passengers up in a hotel overnight, and get a crew to service the plane. The next day they'd take off for the second leg of that long trip to Bombay, India, or coming back in the opposite direction. And this is not going on today at all. Now, from here on, well, incidentally, this lake here is at the bottom of a bowl with mountains around it, and is subject to sudden and very dangerous storms. You would take a dishpan full of water down to Loch Vessel and take a compressed air hose and turn it on it. You can imagine how it would churn the water up. And the Sea of Galilee, at the bottom of a depression here, below sea level, you see, with mountains around it, there are gaps between those mountains, and sometimes a wind comes roaring through one of those gaps and hits the water like that, and almost without warning, it will churn it up into a very dangerous storm. And you read about several of these in connection with the life of Jesus and his 12 disciples in the New Testament. Now, it gets further and further below sea level. The name Jordan means tumbler. Further and further below sea level as it moves along. From about 700 feet below sea level down to here, about 1,300 feet below sea level. This is the deepest ditch on Earth, and the Dead Sea down here is the deepest spot in the world. Part of the Great Rift Valley, a geological crack or fault in the underlying rock that goes clear on down into Africa. And below sea level, you see, the Dead Sea, the surface of it, 1,290 feet, more or less, below sea level, and the water another 1,000 feet deep. Now, one thing more about the Dead Sea before I go back to the Jordan. Here's a peninsula sticking partway across, and on this have been found thousands of graves, an ancient cemetery. And the part south of that is only 12 to 20 feet deep. The part north of that, the water is 1,000 feet deep. American explorers with scuba equipment had worked in there, and they found an underwater seawall, which is today completely submerged, but it is believed that in Bible times this was a dam and was partly above water, therefore, and that the part south of that was dry land, or most only marshy, and not like it is today, submerged under the waters of the Dead Sea. The River Jordan, as you look at it, looks like a straight river, but that's because of the scale of the map. If you would see an air view of it from not too high up, you would see it is a very winding river with an endless series of S-like curves. And as it gets further south, it gets to going through a deeper and deeper canyon, something like the so-called Grand Canyon of Pennsylvania from the northern part of our state. At the bottom of this, a plain about a mile wide, more or less, that is densely grown with weeds and small bushes and trees, called the Zor, or Jungle of the Jordan. In Bible times, this was a hideout of lions, real lions, not just wildcats, bears, hyenas, wolves, four-legged ones, and several kinds of poisonous snakes. And also a favorite hideout of anybody who was on the Palestinian FBI's list of 10 most wanted men. You take your chances with the bears and the lions and the hyenas, but you're safe. But it is unlikely that the sheriff's posse will find you in the jungle of the Jordan. Now the Dead Sea. This is the saltiest natural water on earth. 24% dissolved minerals. Mostly sodium chloride, but also containing valuable chemicals, including bromine, magnesium, and I believe even gold can be chemically extracted from the waters of the Dead Sea. Salt Lake in Utah is only the runner-up for saltiness. The Dead Sea is salty. It has rock salt deposits underneath the bottom of the Dead Sea and on the shores, but in addition to that, you see, it has no outlet. The Jordan River has been flowing in there for who knows how many thousands of years, and there are smaller streams also that flow in, and nothing flows out. So all that water contains small traces of dissolved salt and other minerals, and it all gets left behind there. Nothing gets out of there except by evaporation in the hot sun. And what gets out by evaporation is pure distilled H2O, and the salt and everything else stays behind. So it has become the saltiest water on earth. Now, you cannot sink in the Dead Sea. However, you can drown in it, and in a most undignified posture, with your head down and your feet up. If you do not know how to control yourself in water as heavy as that, then you better not try it. It's dangerous. Many people have drowned that thought they could swim in that water and found they couldn't. If you want to go there as an American tourist, I suggest that you, and want to come home and brag to your friends that you dipped in the Dead Sea, that you do it this way. That's perfectly safe. If you are foolhardy enough to jump in and think you'll swim, and if you don't drown and you get out or somebody rescues you, you have the most intolerable itch from that salty water. Unless you enjoy it, then don't try it. And there's nothing for it but to get on the bus and go 3,700 feet uphill and 20 miles in the horizontal direction to Jerusalem, to your hotel, and try to get a shower with fresh water, and there you may find a little card pinned on the faucet that due to the scarcity of water, it's only turned on from 2 to 5 in the afternoon or something like that. So don't try it. But that's the Dead Sea, and it has no outlet, and it has no light.